to your side?
I think there was another interpretation, and that was, again, just sort of hard-minded business calculation, that they were going to do better in investment terms in something in Europe or the United States or wherever than they were in Iran. That the government was spending so much, they couldn't compete. So I suppose it was basically a mix of both. But there was, you know, that from time immemorial there has been capital fight from countries like Iran, and certainly including Iran. The amounts were substantial, but then the growing wealth substantial too. But I do remember this being discussed in the embassy on a number of occasions, and some, you know, what does this mean, and what can we conclude? Is this a bunch of rats deserting the ship, or what? Uh-huh. You know, kind of question.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, by this time, around 77 or so, how much of the embassy's resources were devoted to reporting on internal social and political conditions in Iran? You had an economic staff looking at the economic scene generally, but in terms of the internal social and political changes that were going on.
Oh, we had a political section.
Yeah.
Doing that all the time, and his regular reporting program. And,
well, some of them were examining foreign policy, foreign political relations.
Yeah.
Not necessarily domestic political.
That is true. But it was both. Our political section had responsibility for dealing with the question overall. Now, I will say this, that we had never been satisfied, ever, with the quality or quantity of our political or our economic reporting for that matter. I mean, we were never convinced that we really knew everything we ought to know about that. But this is not unique either to that time or that country or that embassy. I mean, this is something that you can go through inspector reports from around the world over the last 50 years, and you'll find the same kind of comment being made. So, you know, everybody's saying you should have done more about this or you should have done more about that. Of all people, we were conscious of that and constantly trying to address it.
Okay. Now, with economic problems developing, the Shah made some policy changes, some cabinet changes in the course of 77. He retired Hoveyda and brought in Amuzigar as prime minister. What did you think of the Amuzigar appointment?
Jamshid is a very close, long personal friend of mine. We practically grew up together in a sense of, and I always thought he was an extremely able, very, very intelligent individual. The one thing that he didn't have that Hoveyda had was he was not a politician. Hoveyda was a politician, almost in the Western style of a politician, glad-hander, backslapper, all that sort of thing. Jamshid was a totally different type of person in that sense. He informed himself, analyzed things, and then tried to act accordingly. Missing from that analysis, perhaps, was that political intuition, certainly to the degree that Hoveyda had it. And so he may have no fault of his, and indeed his sort of his rational analysis is probably superior to what Hoveyda's might have been. But as I say, that sort of that added dimension, that political dimension, may not have been there to the extent that it was previously, and therefore certain things were decided on that Hoveyda might not have decided on.
It's just they're decided without looking at the political consequences or costs? Or
I wouldn't say not looking at them, but just not quite having that fine instinct that I suppose politicians are born with. I don't know. But,
how much of a difference did it make otherwise, though, this change in prime minister?
Not enormous difference one way or another. It was a new face, and but, you know, everybody knew that Shah was still boss, and so I think that one anticipated there would be improved efficiency in the running of government, the bureaucracy and things like that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But basic policy changes, no.
Okay. Now, November 77, a few months later, Shah visited Washington to be with Carter for the first time. What kind of a role did the embassy play in planning for such visits? Or was it mostly just a matter of being handled in Washington, planning for these kinds of state visits?
Usually that's done in Washington, yeah.
Now, Charles Knotts recently mentioned that the Shah was somewhat nervous, he used the word nervous, about this visit because he was unsure about the direction of Carter's policy. How visible was this nervousness to you at the embassy or to Sullivan?
Well, I think it manifests itself in the kinds of questions we would get from either the Shah or his senior advisors about some specific issue. And the tenor of the questions would convey an uncertainty or a question mark about something or another. So if Charlie felt that he was nervous, maybe it was because of that. Otherwise, I think we saw I didn't see anything particularly one way or another.
Now, one issue that interested Carter and Vance, as well as other people at this point, was what I mentioned earlier, this question of OPEC price increases, oil price increases, and the Shah's role in determining the direction of OPEC's price policies generally. How much discussion of this issue was there at the embassy before the Shah left for Washington? Trying to get forced to meet with the Shah on this question of his role in OPEC.
I don't really recall any specific discussion. I would only say that it had always been certainly my earnest hope that any argument we would make would be a very sound economically persuasive argument, that we wouldn't try to fog him with a lot of BS which we had tried in the past and which they saw through. I mean, it was just absurd. So that's about all I can say on that.
According to one of the Sullivan's messages that was found in the captured documents, I've seen a copy, the Shah eventually called for an oil price freeze, partly because of, this is the quote for the cable, some blunt talk to the Shah, unquote, about the problems caused by his oil price policies and OPEC price policies generally. Was that the reason the Shah acted as he did, or?
I don't know. Yeah. That's news to me. I don't know what the time is of that particular message.
Sometime in the fall, early 78, late 77.
That's that.
Before you left. Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a copy.
I left in May of 78. Yeah,
that's right.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. Now, Knotts suggested in some ways that the Shah made this concession before he arrived in Washington. He agreed to play some role in calling for a price freeze. Knotts suggested this was not really politically wise in some ways because it might have reduced his credibility at home as a strong supporter of OPEC standing up for Iran's interests and getting more income from Western countries. Was this issue discussed at the embassy? Much talk about what the implications of this move may have been domestically in Iran.
Charlie must have been much more sensitive to this than I was, because being in Washington, where you maybe got a lot more pressure and just talk about this than we did out in Tehran.
Of course, this might have been retrospective at this point. At this point, also, I might have thought this retrospectively. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
As a matter of fact, you know, when you talk about price freeze, I don't even remember anything about that specifically. I do remember sort of the theme of moderation and be reasonable and that sort of thing, always. But beyond that, not. And again, as I said, I'd always been firmly of the belief that if we were going to be making arguments to the Shah, whether it was balance, the arguments from balance of trade or balance payments or world economy, everything else, that whatever arguments we made had to be sound economic arguments and not just baloney or self-serving arguments that they could see through in a minute. They were sophisticated and knowledgeable as we were. And to try and BS them was stupid.
Now, from your vantage point in Tehran, did you have a take on how successful this visit was, the fall of 77 by the Shah?
Well, generally successful, as I recall. This was followed, let's see, which, yeah, it was
a few months later.
Yeah, it was followed by
a typical visit, yeah.
Right.
Did the Shah say anything about the visit when he returned?
I didn't see him. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Yeah.
Wait a minute. I did see him when he came back, and matter of fact, I was at the airport. But why I remember this was that one of our advisors had just been shot the day before, killed, murdered, and I was at the airport, and he got off the plane and. He made some sort of half cryptic remark to me about, well, he said how sorry he was about the advisor and about the news which had just come to him on the plane on his way back. But then he said something about, you know, law and order, and reflecting how, you know, the riots in the campuses in the United States and that sort of thing. And it was sort of a, well, half cryptic, half snide remark about, you know, we handle our people, and in effect, I mean, for us, we handle our people, and you're not very good at it.
Well, demonstrations against the Shah during the course of the visit.
And maybe that
with the tear gas, you know, near the White House.
That, yeah, I guess that was it. But I mean, you know, it was.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, of course, these demonstrations were. Got a lot of attention worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Shah was making a speech with President
Carter.
Right,
Carter's right, yeah.
Were there complaints about that later on to the foreign ministry about the demonstrations, the usual complaints?
Mm-hmm.
This occasion as well, huh? Yeah.
Well, complaint is...
Or comments.
Comments,
yeah.
Lots of comment, I mean, you know.
Okay. And the usual response.
Well, what can you say?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, I read that during the 70s, the Shah, at the request of the U.S. government, provided military aid to various governments in Africa, such as Chad, Somalia, Zaire. And that this question came up at the Washington meeting.
I don't recall military aid. It was financial. Financial.
Financial
assistance. I mean, yeah. I don't recall military aid per se. It's financial.
Okay,
I know.
Let's talk a little bit about this. There are some arms shipments that were expedited with the Shah's cooperation. Maybe not all cases, but certain cases, perhaps. Yeah.
I just don't remember. Yeah. I do remember the money.
You do, yeah. But But apparently the U.S. took the initiative in some cases to ask the Shah if he could provide assistance. Do you recall any of the occasions or the circumstances?
Egypt.
Aid to Egypt.
A country in Africa. Egypt, but I mean,
besides Egypt,
sub-Sahara Africa.
Chad, maybe, or
no,
Somalia?
So, well, we asked about Chad, too. Where was it? Which was the... Well, it was one of the sub-Sahara Africas. And we asked him to help out. And we asked him to do a lot.
How would you explain his willingness or interest in cooperation in these kinds of cases?
Well, I don't want to oversimplify it and by this comment, because it was, I think, much more complex than this. Mm-hmm. But obviously part of it was that he felt our interests were parallel. And that in the context of his analysis of the international situation, this made sense. And therefore it was not just because the United States asked him to do this, but that it made sense from Iran's point of view and from his understanding and appreciation of what was going on internationally. Mm-hmm. And therefore he would do it.
Did you play any role in the discussions over the form or quantity of aid in these countries?
Well, I remember on one occasion, I think we talked about this before.
Perhaps.
A question of aid to Egypt, and it was aid in kind, and the Iranians said, fine, they can, we will give them Iranian trucks, assembled basically, not manufactured from the ground up, but Iranian trucks. And we were sort of, we back in Washington, a certain amount of grumbling about this, and they we said, well, look, I just took a lesson from the United States aid program. You know, when we say aid in kind, you get it in the United States, you don't get it some other country.
Yeah.
Huh. That's, well,
the country does get this.
I don't remember when that was. But.
Yeah. Okay. Under the course of 77, there's increasing opposition activity in Iran. I guess the campuses were ferment. Certainly by the fall, or many campuses were undergoing lots of activity. There were some protests in the bazaar against Shah's economic policies. How much did you know about these developments and during 77? How much did you follow? How closely did you follow these developments? Or how much did they follow at the embassy?
Well, to the extent that, you know, we could. They were followed. I say intensely followed.
Or intently, maybe.
Or intently. not only followed, but reported. I mean, it was not something that we were trying to conceal from anybody in Washington or anything like that. I think that we always. I always worried about whether our analysis of these events were on track or not.
Yeah.
Were they realistic? I don't think I can characterize it beyond that.
To what extent did they raise any questions at the embassy or in your mind about the durability of the Shah's position?
I certainly never dreamed in my wildest dreams that what eventually happened would happen. We understood that as he introduced these measures, as he understood, there was going to be a certain amount of turbulence on the political front as well as on the economic front, so that what was happening didn't come as a major surprise. But I think, having said that, we also believe, I believed, maybe not a belief shared by everybody in the embassy, that these were manageable. This was manageable turbulence. And it was just a necessary part of the evolutionary process. He was first to, you know, he was among the first to say, you know, this is not going to be easy. And there's going to be some problems, but I'm going to go ahead.
Okay. Now, later that same year, at the end of December, President Carter returned the Shah's visit by stopping in Tehran after a visit to Poland, I think. What kind of planning did the state visit by the president require of the embassy?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, when the president visits a country, what does the embassy have to do to arrange the visit?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to go into all of it, but it is a major, major operation. Before a president moves anywhere, you have advance parties.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people descending on you. All kinds of communication facilities put in. Scenarios worked out to the minute in discussions with the Iranians who are going to be responsible for executing much of this. The Secret Service, and I mean, it is just god-awful. You know, the second coming of Christ won't be as complicated. In terms of substance, a good part of this is already worked out. Washington prepared issues to be discussed and responses and so on. We get to make our contribution, but and Charlie may have talked about this if you raise a question with him. 101 details about who's going to be here, who's going to be there, down to the question of what the hell the menu's going to be, you know.
Yeah.
Right, just unbelievable. And so involved, yes, major part of my time, my life was spent dealing with all these kinds of questions and receiving these people and trying to be sure that there wasn't major friction between these clowns that know an Iranian from an Indian and the Iranians who thought they were a bunch of barbarians descending on them, which in many cases it was, but you know. God awful.
In this case, this is a very short visit as well.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. You got this incredible circus, moving circus. You know, British Prime Minister comes to town. They got two security guys and a PR guy, and you know, it's just awful. We've become so goddamn imperial. Talk about imperial.
Imperial presidency. Now, in terms of the actual substance of the meeting, was there much to Carter's visit? I think there was another arms agreement that was announced at the stage.
I don't remember. There may have been some little thing. You know, you always have to have something that you can say, to communicate at the end, we did this or we did that or we agreed to something else. I don't remember. It wasn't any particular. I remember the fine New Year's Eve party we had, but that was something else.
Yeah. Did you hear anything about the discussions between the Shah and Carter? Did they talk about human rights issues, for example?
I do not know. I was not present.
Yeah. Oh, at the banquet, Carter made the famous toast, of course, about the Shah being a man loved by his people and Iran as an island of stability in a troubled part of the world. Do you know who wrote the toast? Charles Nass disclaimed any responsibility for it.
He disclaimed?
Yeah.
He did?
Yeah.
As I was going to say, usually those things are drafted, at least initially drafted.
Well, he might have had an initial draft, but it was changed, initially. Transformed completely.
Yeah.
The White House.
I don't know who I thought it was just Jimmy Carter himself who carried away, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know initially, because I've been on the other end too, those things are drafted and back in the department and sent around and on and up, and they go into a great big book like that.
Now, only a few days later, after the Carter visit, a Tehran newspaper published an article that attacked the Ayatollah Khomeini. And the article sparked demonstrations in Qom that led to violent repression by the police of these demonstrations.
What's your original... Mashhad or Tabriz?
Well, there was in Qom.
Qom,
the demonstration in Qom first, because that's where one of the original religious centers, as you know.
Yeah.
And later on, there's demonstrations in Tabriz and Mashhad and elsewhere. But the Qom incident was, I guess, one of the first incidents of this sort. What was your initial reaction to this, or your initial reading of this development?
Well, I would say the first thing we were trying to do was find out what the hell really happened, because, you know, the newspaper reports are always exaggerated one way or another. One, the official version is something else, and basically we were interested in finding out what really happened. And I think that that, and certainly the Qom, the Tabriz and elsewhere, generally it came across that these were it wasn't just a spontaneous development, that it had been planned in advance, that stacks of rocks had been placed at certain strategic points so that when the moment came, why they were available to throw and so on and so forth. Beyond that, I think it again was, this is part of the expected turbulence that these changes are provoking. The opposition is testing how far this liberalization is going to be permitted. What are the outer limits? The test of the government's ability to deal with it, question of how they deal with it, not only in terms of the incident per se, but the PR aspects of it, etc., etc.
Okay. Now, 40 days later, mid-February, there was there were new demonstrations as part of the period of mourning under Muslim practices.
And a cycle of viciousness in the end, anyhow.
Yeah. So there was Tabriz, there was repression against the demonstrators. This led to a fairly extensive loss of life, Tabriz, at least so I've read. And the city was under martial law until mid-February. And there were demonstrations and violence in other cities around Iran as well. And 40 days later, in late March, there was another cycle, more violence in response as an outgrowth of the period of mourning, like the new protests and some more repression by the government. Now, what was your reading of the political situation by the late winter of 78? Was it again the same idea, this is manageable turbulence?
I was gone by then.
March, April 78, though.
March, April 78. I thought that this was still containable. That the authorities were making some serious mistakes, but hopefully that they would learn from these mistakes and deal with the next round, which we could all anticipate better. And I think, as a matter of fact, they did deal with it in a more sophisticated way, some of the later demonstrations. And generally, I think things died down after a while, and they thought, well, we're back down to a quieter period of time. Not necessarily that this has disappeared, but that it's just quieted down. Both sides have realized that, okay, we've gone so far, and we're beginning to understand what those outer limits are on both sides, so we're going to behave accordingly.
Now, back in Washington, at a State Department seminar that I guess Nas had organized, partly for his edification, he was planning on leaving for Iran, I think this was March, the seminar was held in Jamesville, gave a presentation arguing that the U.S. did not have a bright future in Iran, as these social turbulence and demonstrations were an indication of serious problems, he was arguing. Did you get reports about his presentation at the embassy?
I can't remember what the timing was. I heard about what Bill said and about what some of these other people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just Bill. Marvin Zonas, and there were other people that were coming in and giving us their views.
That's right.
Some at our invitation, others on their own. So I just don't remember the timing of when I heard about this. But let me just say this, that I never heard any clear, articulated, reasoned, extended analysis of where this was all going to go from anybody. Now, there were always people who were predicting for the 30-some years that the Shah was on the throne and he was going to fall the next day for a variety of this reason or that reason or another reason. And certainly, much more plausibly so, say in 1950 or 1960 than in 1977.
Did you discuss these developments with officials from the other embassies? French diplomats or British diplomats, whatever?
Well, there's always the usual exchange of views kind of thing going on with other professionals.
How did they read the situation, from your recollection?
Pretty well. Certainly the British and French and Germans. Germans were a little more alarmist, I would say, than the German ambassador, anyhow, than the others. But the others, pretty much the same as we read it. Troublesome and disturbing, but manageable.
The Iranian friends, like Louis Agar and others, how did they evaluate
it's a very delicate area, dude.
Certainly.
And somewhere in the record is my discussion of my last discussion with Jamshid and Muzigar, and we touched on some of this, but I frankly can't remember basically whatever Jamshid's response was to explain it to me, or to say, well, that's not right, or whatever it was. We touched on it. But Iranians didn't tell me, this is it, we're down the tubes. No.
Were there any rumors floating around Iran or Tehran that year about the state of the Shah's health?
Those rumors were recurrent. I know that they, after I left this in the summer of 78, there were very strong rumors, and he sort of disappeared up the Caspian and all that sort of thing. There were rumors before that, which we were constantly trying to track down one way or another. And we keep getting back reports, his doctor in Switzerland gave him a clean bill of health, and he went there for an annual checkup, as you know. And the ambassador, whoever saw him, would always sort of look for signs, how's he doing, and is he full control of his faculties, and does he look all right? And sometimes he looked kind of tired, and you'd say, well, but the guy puts in, 18-hour days, and I'd be tired too. So certainly nobody knew about the cancer except the French, and they never told us.
Neither the French doctors or the French government, perhaps?
I don't know how much the French government knew, but certainly the French doctors knew. French government may well have known, but they didn't tell us all. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah. Now, around this time, March, April 78 or so, Michael Latrinko, who was the U.S. consul, Tabriz, was reporting the demonstrations reflected widespread and deep opposition to the Shah. So the Washington Post reported a couple of years ago an article about the revolution. Mm-hmm. Did you talk to Ushchenko about his reports, or
I talked to Vic Thompson and Mike about their reports. Well, not only them, but there were others. I'm trying to think of the other fellow in our political section who was also focused mainly on internal politics. I don't remember. Mike may have characterized our conversation.
We hit that stage. Yeah.
Or another, I certainly discussed it with them because, you know, I mean, it's. And I do remember more specifically a couple of reports that Vic Thompson had written, Shiraz. Uh-huh. So I was trying to think of Shiraz.
Right.
And of course, the student element there was more focused, and there was more contact there than there was in some of the other places. And I went over in considerable detail some of Vic's reporting on that. But I didn't suppress the report. I mean, it went back to Washington.
Well, I've read, also according to the Post, that these reports were given somewhat lower status. They were sent out as air grants instead of cables because
that's the way they were written.
Oh, yeah.
One, and two, they were, you know, a number of pages long. You don't send 20-page telegrams. You send it in an airgram.
Apparently I read that they were in some ways treated with less priority because they contradicted the views of the political officers at the embassy. But again, this is...
They were sent. I mean, there's a report from our consul, and he's... Yeah. It's a perfectly legitimate function for him. My legitimate function was to discuss it with him and see what the basis for his assessment was and why he came to these views and so on and so forth. But, you know, that was it. It went back.
Did you have any particular disagreements with either Thompson or Ushchenko about their reading or their interpretation of a situation? I haven't seen these reports, so I really don't know what they say.
I don't say disagreement. I think my question was, I do remember having questions about it, but my question was more, you know, why are you saying this, or what's the basis for your reaching this conclusion? What I wanted to know. Or explain yourself, I mean, when you write this analysis, explain why it is that you've reached this conclusion, or that you've described this trend. It was more the role, if you will, of editor, which is one of the roles of DCM, than a critic of the substance.
Okay. Now, in March, Cyrus Vance visited Tehran again for, I guess, the annual Central meeting.
Right.
Or periodic Central meeting.
Right.
Was he briefed on internal developments? Did he show any interest in
that was more, it was really more focused on, he had a brief meeting with the Shah, but it really was the Cento ministers and Cento business, and it was just one of those chores that, as a matter of fact, we said we should, you know, the secretary should have gotten rid of 10 years ago. I mean, this is just wastes everybody's time and doesn't really get you anywhere. But it just, you know, it had a life of its own, and every secretary, we'd always say, you know, forget it, and they'd say, no, we got to go, they did it last year. So it went on and on and on. So it really was a Cento meeting that happened to be in Tehran, and it was very little to do with Iran-American relations, per se.
I see. Okay. Now, also in March, there was a debate within the State Department over whether to approve an Iranian order for tear gas used for crowd control. What role did the embassy play in this debate?
Not much. Yeah. I think we were asked about it, but or somehow or another it got to us. But this was a Washington question as much as anything. Mm-hmm. I think the embassy may have recommended approval. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The records would show this somewhere or another. I don't remember the debate much beyond that.
Okay. The Nas is obviously clearly deeply involved in it. We talked about his other interview, but he was in the Washington events.
Right.
So, okay. Now, in the spring of 78, the embassy began to make contacts with various elements of the political opposition.
Right.
Had this process begun before you left for Washington?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Stemple was one. I think Archie Bolster was one. Is Archie there?
No, he's gone. He's back in Washington, then he later goes to the Hague.
Certainly John, and I think there were a couple of others who, again, let me put this in context. Things are loosening up. There's a certain amount of ferment. We've got to know more than we do know about what's going on. So, but we can operate in this new environment better, with a better understanding of the authorities than we could have before, where, you know, any direct contact with the opposition would, with any meaningful opposition, would be known immediately and misinterpreted as being somehow plotting against the government.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't quite the same, say, in the spring of 78, where you could, it was more understandable, and we could explain ourselves in a more acceptable way, if the question were raised.
By the foreign ministry and all.
Right.
Do you recall how early in the year this
right around the time of the Tabriz, or before that, as things were beginning, you know, to bubble, we said, you know, let's find out what the hell's going on.
That's how you felt, that you supported this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Christ, yeah, I mean, that's our job.
Do you recall who some of the figures of the embassy was in touch with around this time?
Barzagan was one I remember just off the top of my head.
Of Liberation Movement for Iran, I guess that was his organization, something along that line.
There were some of the old National Fronters and some of the Bizarres. A few people in the media, I mean, in the press. Some academics. Who else? Well, that's a fairly broad spectrum right there.
Do you recall if any conclusions were reached or drawn from these early contacts with opposition figures like Bazargan?
Not any hard conclusions one way or another. It was many cases informative. You often got special pleading, you know, the United States support us, but that was, it almost went with any contact, you make it way, you've got to support us. And in their mistaken belief that somehow or another the United States is going to make it happen.
Good change of taker.